Coming up next, Maria LaHood discusses Maher Arar, targeted assassination, Corey v. Caterpillar, and the Shell Oil Company's torturous operations in Nigeria. So we're joined now by Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you.
First off, in a brief, let's talk about what the CCR group does. What is the center mainly focused upon?
Well, we do legal and educational work to create positive social change. We have an international human rights docket, which I'm in. Generally, we bring cases against multinational corporations or former foreign government officials for torture and extrajudicial killings and war crimes abroad. We also have cases against U.S. officials like that. We have the Guantanamo docket, which represents Guantanamo detainees and habeas claims and in damages actions once they're released. We also have a government misconduct and racial justice docket, which does domestic work regarding government misconduct.
Now, the main case we want to talk about today is the case of Maher Arar, who is a Canadian citizen, formerly from Syria, but he came to Canada when he was a teen. Is that correct? Or at least a young man?
Yes, that's right. When he was 17.
Let's start for the audience in case they don't know the case. Let's give a brief overview of what happened. He was detained at JFK.
Yeah. Well, he was, you know, Maher's software engineer. He had been, been living in Canada since he was 17. He's now almost 40. He had never been back to Syria. He was with his family in Tunisia, where his wife is from, and he was called back to work in Canada. He had actually worked at a company in outside of Boston for a while and did a lot of travel back and forth, even when he was living in Canada. So he was called back to Canada for work, and he had American Airlines miles, so he went through JFK. But when he got to JFK, he was taken out of line, interrogated, questioned, kept at JFK for 2 days. He wasn't allowed to leave, to catch his flight, to make a phone call. Then they took him into Brooklyn, to the Metropolitan Detention Center, still, you know, for 5 days. Nobody, his family, had any idea where he was because he wasn't allowed to call. Finally, he was allowed to make a phone call. You know, they were questioning him about his ties to certain people. They were trying to get him to go to Syria instead of to Canada, and of course he refused and told them he would be tortured if he were sent to Syria. You know, when he was able to reach his family, they got an immigration attorney to come visit him. So the immigration attorney came on a Saturday, had a meeting with him. The next day, on Sunday, they took him out of his cell at 6 o'clock at night and said they wanted to question him. He said, "Where is my attorney?" They told him she didn't want to come, or he didn't want to come. She was actually a female. They questioned him for 6 hours. I'm sorry, this was at 9 o'clock in the evening. Questioned him for 6 hours until 3 a.m. about his fears about being sent to Syria. He repeatedly told them he would be tortured there and why, and asked for his attorney. It ends up they had called his attorney that day at her office on a Sunday to tell her about the Sunday night questioning. Of course, she didn't get that message until Monday. On Monday, when she called looking for him, they lied and told her that he was on his way to New Jersey, when in fact he was still in Brooklyn. The next night at 4 a.m, they took him out of his cell. They told him he had been deemed to be a member of Al-Qaeda based on classified evidence that they couldn't share with him. They put him on a jet plane where he was taken to Jordan via Italy. He was beaten in Jordan for the day and then taken over into Syria. In Syria, he was whipped with electrical cables for 2 weeks and beaten and interrogated up to 18 hours a day with questions similar to those questions he had been asked in the United States. Nobody knew where he was. The U.S. never told his lawyer or the consular office that he was sent to Syria. Canada finally found out from Syria that he was there. Meanwhile, for 10 months, he was in a underground cell-like or grave-like cell that was 3 feet wide, 7 feet tall, and 6 feet long. It was, you know, dark, dank, filthy, and that's where he lived and didn't see daylight. And then he was finally, a couple months later, after a year of being in Syria, you know, after Canadian pressure, he was released home to Canada.
So he was captured. He was detained September 2002. So he was basically released around September 2003?
October 2003.
October 2003. Yeah. So I'm curious about, considering the context of the time, the U.S. government had been ratcheting up a campaign towards Syria as part of its new global war on terror, your forest against us. And Syria with Assad, they were fairly on the fence as far as the public narrative in the U.S. was. How does it come to be that Syria gets him and winds up being tortured in Syria?
Right. No, it's, I mean, you know, Syria has repeatedly been on the State Department's list of countries who use torture and interrogations. They're on the list of countries as state sponsors of terrorism themselves.
Right.
And, you know, all of a sudden, the U.S. is using them as an ally to torture, essentially.
Right. See, Jordan, if you said Jordan, it wouldn't surprise me because we do
have a
strong diplomatic relationship with Jordan. But Syria strikes me as an
odd one. And that's why some people think he was actually, although he was technically, you know, the removal order sent him to Syria, he wasn't dropped off in Syria. He was dropped off in Jordan, but obviously with the intent to have him delivered to Syria because of those diplomatic issues.
Now, do we have a sense of intel they were trying to gain from him in Syria?
Well, they, you know, the questions he was asked were about Al-Qaeda, about certain people he knew. He was actually, you know, tortured into falsely confessing that he had been to Afghanistan in a training camp. Of course, he's never been to Afghanistan. So, I mean, those are the kinds of things that he was being asked. He was, you know, when he was released to Canada, Canada launched a 2.5-year public inquiry, which, you know, resulted in a 1,200-page report and fully exonerated him, said he didn't have, there was no evidence of any ties whatsoever to terrorism, to any offense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And when Syria released him, they said he's nobody, there's nothing, you know. It's only the United States who continues to keep him on a watch list.
And the government of Canada not only settled the case, they gave him a formal apology and a $10.5 million Canadian dollar settlement?
Right. They formally apologized, the Prime Minister did, and, yeah, awarded him a settlement for what Canada had done. And Canada, what Canada had found it did was gave the U.S. false information, false and inflammatory information. They didn't, you know, there was some infighting in Canada, and they didn't get him out of Syria soon enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were government leaks after he came back, you know, smearing his name. So those were the things. The Commission of Inquiry found that Canada hadn't actually been complicit in his removal to Syria or in his torture, but had done those other things.
So let's move to how this winds up involving John Ashcroft. Obviously, the detention at JFK under the new rules is the primary thing. But let's talk about the U.S. case. How did we progress from the Canadian commission to the U.S. case?
So, well, Maher, you know, Maher had brought a case against Canada and Canada. And then, soon, you know, a few months after his release, CCR brought a case on his behalf against the U.S. officials who were responsible. So it was not only John Ashcroft, but the Deputy Attorney General at the time, Larry Thompson, the FBI Director, Robert Mueller, and then INS officials, the then INS, the immigration officials who were involved. You know, each of them had their role to play in his, you know, in sending him to Syria to be tortured. And we alleged also in the conspiracy to prevent him from going to court while he was in New York to stop them from sending him to a country where he would be tortured, which is the law of the United States and international law. You're not permitted to send someone to a country where there's a reasonable, where there's a risk that they'll be tortured. So we filed that case back in 2004 in Brooklyn in the Eastern District of New York. And that was dismissed essentially on national security and foreign policy grounds. The defendants, the individual defendants, moved to dismiss the case, and then the U.S. government came in and said the case can't be litigated because of so-called state secrets.
Right.
So the court didn't rule on the state secrets motion, but decided even without that, just because the, you know, the individual said it implicated national security and the government said that, well, the case then shouldn't be litigated. So we appealed that decision to the Second Circuit here in New York. We got an affirmance of that dismissal, 2-1, for generally on the same grounds. When we were getting ready to actually petition the full, 11-12 member Court of Appeals, the day before that was due, they decided on their own to rehear the case. So, you know, this brings us up to 2007, I guess. Mm-hmm. The appeals decision was 2007, then it was, I guess, 2009 or 2008 that they heard the case, 2009 that they decided the case. Unfortunately, they decided again that Maher couldn't seek justice in the courts, and that was a 7-4 decision. In both of these appellate decisions, we had, really strong dissents talking about how, this is essentially providing impunity to federal officials who torture and who, prevent someone from going to court. So we then petitioned the Supreme Court for review of that decision earlier this year. And then just on Monday, the Supreme Court denied that request.
The Supreme Court doesn't often explain why they deny a case, but do they have an explanation this time?
No, they didn't. Nothing. Sometimes there will be a dissent, and we didn't get a dissent. There was just a denial and notification that Justice Sotomayor, who had sat on the Second Circuit, didn't take part in the consideration of the petition. So unfortunately, we don't know their thinking.
So essentially, what does this mean in the U.S. courts then?
Well, it means, it means several things. It means, for Maher, it means he can't get justice there.
Right.
It means there's not remedy for a torture victim like him. It means the government, in any sort of instance where the government can claim they did something or that national security or foreign affairs was involved, that they are immune, or they can have have impunity. They have an argument that the judiciary cannot review what they've done. So it doesn't just affect non-citizens; it affects citizens. They could kill a U.S. citizen and say we did it out of national security, and the court can't review it.
In fact, we'll get to that when we talk about targeted assassination here in a minute. So that's actually an important point you made, that a U.S. citizen versus a foreign national. Arar is a Canadian citizen. Did the courts at any time weigh in on this on the grounds of being a non-U.S. citizen? Or has it always been in the state secrets realm?
Well, there were certain issues. At different points, the government had argued that really this was an immigration removal. This was not, sending him to be tortured, and that the immigration scheme prevented a case being brought for damages. As far as, there were also arguments that he didn't have a right to counsel because he wasn't a U.S. citizen. There were arguments that, because he's not a U.S. citizen, the Constitution doesn't apply.
Let's look at that right there. That's been a very popular commentary by the apologists who want to excuse torture. Is there case law that basically refutes that?
Well, yes, there is. I mean, there's case law. The case law is a little bit complicated, but we argued that he was, it's clear in this case because he was on United States soil. And there's no question that, for non-citizens on U.S. soil, they have a constitutional right. So his constitutional right was to not be sent somewhere to be tortured and arbitrarily detained. So here there's no question. There may be an argument elsewhere that due process doesn't apply abroad, but we think that's wrong as well. We think that due process and the Constitution follows U.S. authority. But that wasn't so much a problem here because Maher was in the United States.
As an attorney, what do you think the consequences are with this way of looking at law in the last several years? I'm not a lawyer. I did kind of grow up in Vincent Elkins' law firms, though, as a kid. If we make rights about something that an individual has, as opposed to rights that are endemic in the system itself, it's something that we place in the system regardless of your intelligence of your rights. To me, those are two different worlds. I tend to want to live in the world where the rights are secure because that's the proper process just for good justice. It means we actually possibly get the bad guy and we don't incarcerate innocent people. But that doesn't seem to be the way the government has been behaving either under the Bush administration or the Obama administration. Is that your take?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And unfortunately, the way, you know, we need to try to enforce these rights is by individual claims. And if you have, you know, if you have claims that can't go forward, you have no way to enforce the law, then the law is meaningless.
And you have no way to figure out what the actual legis is.
Right.
Okay. Congressional remedies. Can you think of, or has anyone suggested a congressional remedy to this court decision?
Well, you know, the Second Circuit itself had said, you know, they're not going to imply a constitutional remedy because Congress has other schemes. And because Congress hasn't specifically said there's a damages remedy for an extraordinary rendition, you know, we think that's ridiculous. It's clear that there's a remedy for torture and conspiracy to torture, and that's what this was. You know, we also brought a Torture Victim Protection Act claim, and the court found that, you know, U.S. officials, federal officials, couldn't be held liable if the Syrian officials were acting at their behest. They could only be liable if they were acting at the behest of Syrian officials. So, you know, if they were almost more culpable, they can't actually be liable. So, I mean, I think there are certain things that Congress could do. I mean, to us, again, the law is clear. But now in the Second Circuit, you know, it isn't. So there are things, I think, that Congress could do. It's also possible that Congress could provide a direct remedy to Maher and apologize. So not just sort of fix the law, but also provide a remedy specifically for Maher.
What about external remedies, World Court, Hague, things like that?
Well, it's certainly, you know, there are options that we are thinking about. You know, there's the Inter-American Commission. There's, you know, Maher's plane went through Italy. There were Italian, we know that there was, you know, Italian convictions of CIA officials for an extraordinary rendition. Mm-hmm. So that might be something. The RCMP, which is the federal law enforcement agency in Canada, is actually criminally investigating both Syrian and United States officials. You know, so there's an opportunity there to hold U.S. officials accountable. There's still the, you know, there is still pressure that can be put on President Obama to apologize, provide a remedy, take Maher off the watch list, initiate a criminal investigation of those responsible, which is something that, you know, members of Congress have called for. And at the time, Attorney General Mukasey said no, he wouldn't do it at this time. It's something that that Attorney General Holder could do. There are certainly other opportunities for accountability here.
Okay.
It's just something that needs to be pressed.
Well, I hope as they emerge, you'll share those with us because that's the main thing we're looking for is accountability. By the way, you're listening to Veracity Radio. We're here talking with Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights, senior staff attorney. Let's move to another case you had that's, I think, interrelated to this same concept based in the Obama administration's decision to assassinate on site, if necessary, Alaki. There has been a case that we've looked at before with Avi Dichter. So tell us about the targeted assassination case.
Well, we brought, you know, a targeted is almost a misnomer in that case because it was a so-called targeted assassination. But basically, Avi Dichter had decided to drop a one-ton bomb on a residential apartment building in Gaza in the middle of the night in order to kill a purported Hamas leader. 15 civilians were killed, 8 children. And, you know, it destroyed, I think, 40 buildings. You know, it was a completely disproportionate attack and it also targeted civilians. You know, we allege they knew civilians were there and they had intelligence of the possibility of at least 10 civilians being there. So we had brought a claim. Avi Dichter was here in the United States for a year, and we brought an Alien Tort Statute case against him and a Torture Victim Protection Act claim as well. And that case was dismissed, again, on immunity grounds. Basically, the government of Israel came in and said that he was acting on behalf of Israel and should be immune. So the lower court dismissed on that basis, and then actually the
So that would be a jurisdictional limit that the court ruled upon? They said they had no jurisdiction on the matter?
Right.
Okay.
Right. It was a foreign, you know, at that point in the lower court, the court found that the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act,
okay,
which is a statute, provided immunity, even though the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act on its face only applies to actual foreign states and their agencies. The court found it applied to individuals. So that is now incorrect law. The Supreme Court recently, in the Samatar decision, decided that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act does not apply to former government officials. But when we got to the Second Circuit, so the U.S. government also came in and basically said he deserves immunity under common law, so not under the statute, mm-hmm. But because we say so. He should have immunity if his own government, the Israeli government, says so, mm-hmm. or if we say so, the U.S. government. And here we both say so. So we moved on to the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the dismissal on the common law immunity grounds, basically giving deference to the U.S. position. So that's, again, a case of utter impunity for killings, for war crimes.
Now, this would also be a collective punishment crime? Again, since the U.S. won't hear the court case, what additional international bodies would be willing to or able to hear this case?
Well, this case has actually been brought in other places.
Okay.
There was, you know, it's interesting, in a broader targeted assassinations case that was brought challenging the policy in Israel, the Israeli High Court actually said, you know, sort of hypothetically, if you had a bomb that killed scores of civilians, that would be disproportionate in a targeted assassination. Mm-hmm. For this case specifically, it's actually now in Spain, a criminal case was brought. It has been dismissed, but now it's before the Constitutional Court, I believe. So there are other efforts internationally to bring Israeli officials, to account for this specific bombing.
And in the case of targeted assassination, again, since Obama has allowed the discussion to go forward about a targeted assassination on an American citizen, al-Awlaki, in Yemen, do we have examples where targeted assassination ended in a conviction somewhere in the world?
No, I'm sure. Well, I guess, again, it might depend on what we mean by targeted assassination.
Okay.
Certainly disappearances and extra. I mean, you know, we call it a targeted assassination because somebody decides that this person should die, and
right.
they try to do it from a distance, basically, you know. I mean, what it is an extrajudicial killing, you
right.
know, which is contrary to international law. It might depend on what legal regime applies,
mm-hmm.
whether it's international humanitarian law or human rights law. You know, for al-Awlaki, it's there, you know, Yemen is not a battlefield. So international humanitarian law doesn't apply. It is, you know, it would be an extrajudicial killing. I know that, of course, there people have been held liable for disappearances, for extrajudicial killings. I'd have to think about it for something specifically called a targeted assassination. I mean, certainly we know that President Obama has increased the use of targeted assassinations over and above what the Bush administration did, and that this is the first time that we know of that an American has been on such a list.
Now, if I were simply to think of terrorism conflict in real simple terms of wanting to stop terrorism, it makes sense to me. Maybe if I thought I really had a bad guy, that instead of taking a big army and going there and potentially killing lots of people, that you know, taking the one guy out who's the center of it makes sense. But what's wrong with this this scenario, this theory?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, with regard to an American citizen, they're certainly entitled to due process.
Okay.
You know, we can't, you can't just have
Do they give up due process if they turn on their government?
Well, there is, you know, if somebody, there is an argument that if somebody is in an imminent threat, that that there is a self-defense argument,
right.
You know. I think, you know, I mean, they're certainly entitled to more than, you know, you make some statements, you're on a kill list.
Right. A lot of people would be on that list.
Right. And, you know, then it might, yeah. So, again, it, you know, it depends on the legal regime, but to, you know, it's obviously unprecedented to say, you know, here's an American citizen, and we're going to kill him with no process whatsoever and with utter secrecy, and no notice of what, you know, what about criminal charges? What about charging him? What about trying him? What about capturing him?
They can do this in absentia, right?
Yeah, they could. I mean, you know, there are always issues with that as well. But yes, that would, you know, bringing criminal charges, you know, giving notice of what the actual allegations against him are,
right,
are the first step.
That's what, for the listeners, that's actually what Italy did. They found the 23 CIA agents guilty, but again, it was in absentia. So no going to Italy for a while, or at least, and also
or countries that might extradite.
Exactly.
Italy.
So staying with Israel for a minute, I want to talk about the Rachel Corrie Caterpillar case. This is a case I remember very well. The for the audience who don't know, Rachel Corrie stood between a Caterpillar bulldozer and a house to be demolished. And okay, so an IDF official or a soldier is driving this tank and ran her over. Claims he couldn't see her, but anyone who's seen the pictures can clearly tell there's plenty of room to see what was happening. There was no imminent threat. This was basically a murder. Now, how did this go from being something that, frankly, by the way, got buried in the American media? It got lost. How do we get from there to a court case?
Well, as you know, as you said, we have a 23-year-old college student who's in Gaza with the International Solidarity Movement, who's murdered, and you know, there's still, you know, Israel had never held an impartial investigation. There's never been, you know, there's been so many problems with how this was handled, both with Israel and with the State Department not pushing as hard as they could.
At the time, the State Department, this was in 2003, March 16, 2003. So the State Department at the time was, number one, fully ratcheted up in the gear towards going to invade Iran. Iraq. And was obviously not at all sympathetic to any activist organization that would be contrary to that and or contrary to Israel.
So we represented Rachel Corrie's parents, and we also represented four Palestinian families who were in their homes when their homes were demolished on top of them and family members were killed or injured, again, by Caterpillar bulldozers. So we brought a case against Caterpillar for war crimes because they, we alleged, knowingly sold the D-10, D-9 and D-10 bulldozers to the IDF, knowing that they would be used for war crimes to unlawfully demolish homes in the occupied Palestinian territory. The case was brought in the state of Washington in federal district court there, and it was dismissed without a hearing on various grounds. We appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit, at that point, the U.S. government came in and said, you know, in an amicus brief, not in a statement of interest, not providing any evidence, said, well, we pay for the bulldozers, so you can't challenge what Caterpillar does in selling them to the IDF because we pay for them, and that would be a challenge to our foreign policy. And basically, that's a political question, not a legal or judicial question. And the Ninth Circuit bought it. They took evidence outside of what was in the record and said, this is a political question. The case can't be adjudicated. So, you know, that was a huge disappointment. We petitioned for en banc rehearing for the full Ninth Circuit, and they did not hear it. So that case ended with, again, deference to what the U.S. government said when it came in on behalf of the defendant with regards to Israel. So Rachel Corrie's parents actually have a case that's currently in trial in Israel against Israel for Rachel's killing.
And that was filed this year?
No, it was actually filed in 2005 at the same time.
Oh, okay.
It finally went to trial this year, but there's a recess in the trial, and it's continuing, I believe, in September.
Okay. Any sense of the impartiality of that court?
No, you know, I don't have a sense.
Okay.
I know that you know that often, frankly, Israeli courts are more willing to stand up to Israeli, you know, violations than U.S. courts. So I'm, you know, hoping that some justice will be done.
And last, sticking with the discussion of torture, but moving into something that I think, especially living here on the Gulf, this week we watched Exxon, Shell, BP, all these big wigs go up on Capitol Hill and defend their industry and defend their practices. And one of the areas of the world that when we see people leaving, when we see these rigs leaving and say they'll go find their oil elsewhere, one of the areas that most Americans may not talk about and know about is what's happening in Nigeria with Royal Dutch Shell. So let's not get too into the total picture of what's happening with the Nigerian from the pollution aspects and all that, but there are torture cases related to this. And let's give a quick overview on the Wiwa versus Shell case.
Well, Shell has a joint venture with the Nigerian government to take oil out of the Niger Delta. Mm-hmm. And in the 90s, early 90s, the movement against Shell in Nigeria in response to the taking of land, in response to the gas flaring, in response to, you know, the failure of Shell to clean up oil spills and then, you know, other environmental damage. Mm-hmm. There was a grassroots movement that was protesting Shell's behavior there. And what Shell would do, in partnership with the police and the military, they would call them in to break up protests and they would shoot people.
This is kind of like Coca-Cola in Colombia.
Right. So a couple of our, a few of our clients were victims that way. A few of our clients were tortured. And then basically in the mid-90s, there was, the leaders of the movement, the main leader being Ken Saro-Wiwa, who was a renowned author and playwright at the time and headed the Ogoni movement, was arrested and detained along with other Ogoni leaders. On sham charges and basically convicted in a sham trial and executed 10 days later. They were the Ogoni Nine. So we represented six of their families and other people who were either tortured or shot with Shell's complicity by the military. The case went on for 13 years. Just last year, we were ready to go to trial here in Manhattan. And the case settled. So it was a public settlement, which was great. It was $15.5 million. There was a $5 million trust for the benefit of the Ogoni people that was established. And the rest of the money, was divided among the plaintiffs for compensation for their injuries.
Any policy changes in Nigeria and or in Shell?
I don't know. I think even the fact that we brought the case, in 96 against, Royal Dutch Shell, who weren't even, they were the parent companies based in England and in Holland. And then later we brought it against the Nigerian subsidiary and the head of the Nigerian subsidiary. I think that was around the time, frankly, that we started seeing a lot more, talk about corporate social responsibility and a lot more awareness about what corporations were doing abroad and how they had double standards and how they, the failure to value life in other places. So I don't know sort of in direct response to the settlement so much, but I think in response to the possibility of litigation in U.S. courts, mm-hmm. there have been, not nearly enough, obviously, but there have been, I think, some moves toward trying to comply with human rights. But again, we're very far from where we need to be. And you bring up the, I don't know if, there was an article about how, sort of talking about the BP spill here and talking about how every year in the Niger Delta is, you know, the amount of money not from offshore drilling, the amount of oil, not from offshore drilling, but just from spills, from dilapidated pipes, you know, is the equivalent of one Exxon Valdez spill. And who's, you know, who's trying to hold those oil companies responsible for that? You know, if it's in the Gulf here in the United States, it's much more visible, obviously.
It's hard to hide this one. Some nuance here on the Dutch Shell complicity in that. How did they become someone who was that involved? Or was it a blind eye? Did they turn a blind eye to it? Or do we have an evidence that they knew, you know?
There were several different events, and the evidence differed for each of them. For one of the shootings, you know, we had evidence that Shell actually brought in the military. For another shooting, they not only brought in the military, they also had, it was actually a contractor at the time that brought in the military, but there was other evidence around that case as well. But there was another shooting where they not only brought in the military, but they paid the military afterwards. For the trial, there was evidence that a Shell lawyer was actually present when witnesses were bribed to testify for the prosecution against our clients, as well as, you know, their presence at the trial and participation. There was a discussion had with one of our clients who was trying to save Ken Sarawiwa, his brother, from execution, and basically the head of the Shell Nigerian subsidiary said, call off the campaign, call off the protests, and we'll see what we can do. So there was, you know, there was evidence showing their complicity. There was also just the joint venture. You know, the Shell was in partnership with the military regime for the purpose of extracting the oil and selling the oil. And it was, you know, clearly an effort to stifle the protest against that that led to these killings and torture.
By the way, you're listening to Veracity Radio. We're here talking with Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights, senior staff attorney. I'm going to ask you one final question here in a minute, but looking at BP, for instance, and it would be very interesting to tie these together over time, is that I will be covering 100 years worth of BP history, looking at how they participated in repression in Iran for their own profits and gains and for the gains of the British government. Because this is something that we don't hear about as much. We now see a big old spill, but you can go back through their history and the history of some of these other corporations and watch them work very complicit. I mean, in fact, anyone who has a sense of history about the East India Company should know what the British did when trade was being disrupted. They basically took over an entire country to guarantee that. So the final question I want to ask you, though, is in light of this, these cases against U.S. officials, what do you think average citizens are going to be able to do if they wanted to see someone like, say, Richard B. Cheney in jail for authorizing waterboarding and authorizing torture, for supporting a regime that, in the case of Guantanamo, is now about to maybe hold 30 or less people accountable when close to 2,000 had been detained there. So how do you think citizens are going to ever get accountability?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there are various avenues. I mean, none of them are that, you know, I mean, we've been running up against a lot of blockades on that.
Right, you're the pros. I mean, if you guys aren't able to always get it.
People need to demand, you know, that Holder criminally investigates torture. You know, there are foreign jurisdictions. We, CCR, actually, you know, brought criminal complaints in Germany and France against Rumsfeld and others for torture in Abu Ghraib and other places. And again, there was this deference to the executive, you know, deference to the U.S. That took place, and they weren't willing to hold them accountable. There are now currently Spanish criminal investigations.
Baltasar Garzón.
Yes, in you know, against U.S. officials. So I think there are ways. I certainly think it's not going to happen unless people do, you know, rally around making it happen and really demand that the U.S. government do something. And I think it's, you know, it is necessary to make sure that it doesn't happen again. I mean, if people aren't held personally accountable, then what prevents it from recurring? You know, no matter what the Obama administration says about its current policies, you know, there's nothing but accountability that can stop it.
The website is ccrjustice.org, the Center for Constitutional Rights. We've been listening to Maria LaHood, and I want to thank you for joining us at Veracity Radio and hope you will come back as we look at these cases progressing and as we follow what CCR does for us. So I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You have a good weekend.